As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
This is The Athletic Football Show.
Welcome. The Athletic Football Show. Today's Tuesday, December 14th. I'm Robert Mays. Mitchell Schwartz is traveling today. He will be back with us later in the season. Do not worry. But pinch hitting in his stead is our good friend, Nate Tice. Nate, how you doing, buddy?
Doing great. Wait, I mean, it's twice in 12 hours, it feels like.
We should just keep recording the whole time through. I mean, might as well just not even sleep on Sunday nights into Monday mornings.
Hey, Ken, I'm keeping it on, Kent. You can, producer Kent, I'm just going to keep it on. You can edit it later. That's it. We'll just have one 24-hour little file that we send you.
You had some French soak pie last night after the show, huh? How was that?
Oh, my God.
I love a good French soak pie.
It's my favorite, my absolute favorite pie. I was such a picky eater as a kid. And then my mom, you know, so like apple pie, I like apple pie now.
The opposite of me. My dad used to say I would eat anything not moving faster than me.
I know my entire family now I eat everything, but that was the thing is when I was in high school, there's a couple schools that recruited me as a tight end and everyone, I was 195 pounds, 6'4", just real thin. Oh, I know. And everyone was like, really tight end? And then they looked at my dad and they're like, he'll put on weight. he'll get there. And then sure enough, when you're broke in college and starving, you start eating everything you can. So yeah, that weight came on quick.
I was 225 my senior year, like 222. Okay. My junior though, I was 245. So I was much bigger than you in high school, despite being six inches shorter than you.
Yeah. My first varsity experience, James Laurinaitis tore me in half. I was 160 pounds as a sophomore and he absolutely T-boned me. And I that's the last thing I remember is going up in the air with James Laurinaitis on top of me. So yeah, that's why I learned, oh, maybe I should start lifting weights.
Or play quarterback.
Or play quarterback. Right, yeah, exactly. Exactly.
All right. As we always do on Monday into Tuesday, we're doing the mailbag today. Really appreciate you guys sending in the questions. A lot of fun ones today. We have a nice breezy energy with this guy as we get a little bit later into the season. So Kent, why don't you cue up the first voicemail for us?
Hi, Robert. Nate. Yesterday on the show, you talked about the problems with the Panthers and the Jaguars. And, of course, Urban Meyer and Matt Rhule both came straight from coaching college to NFL head coaching jobs. So I was curious. I looked up others who've done that in the last, say, 20 years. Cliff Kingsbury, of course, Bill O'Brien, Chip Kelly, Doug Marrone, Greg Schiano, Jim Harbaugh, Bobby Petrino, Nick Saban, Steve Spurrier, Butch Davis. And I guess my question is, you know, what are your thoughts on the pros and cons of somebody making that move? Anyway, thanks a lot. Andy Taylor, Pax Tank, PA. Bye-bye.
It's a great question from Andy. I just, it being 1 a.m. is probably why I didn't mention it last night, because it is a connection point between those two guys. And I wanted to ask you this, because you obviously played in college, you've been around college coaches, you've been around NFL coaches for a very long time. Do you think that there's a difference in the skill set? And do you feel like there is something inherent to what makes a college coach successful that doesn't necessarily make a pro coach successful? Or do you feel like this is anecdotal? I thought you'd have a good sense of it.
Yeah, I've never been a real fan from a guy going from college to the NFL. It really, the alarm bell for me is if they have zero NFL experience.
Mm-hmm. Why is that? What aspect of it?
I mean, just the whole process of coaching an NFL professional. It's a lot different. It really is. In college, it's my way or the highway. And you can do that with a lot of guys. I mean, they joke about de-recruiting guys because they just blah, 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 blah. And they, you control their lives. You really do. You got school. You can always hang something over a guy. In the NFL, a player can just come in and go, no. I got a 7-year deal. I know I'm the franchise guy. No, it's a lot more that leading of adults that needs to happen. Not that college coaches don't do that. There's dozens of coaches I've been around that have just been, they have that and they maybe prefer the college lifestyle. But I would say recruiting is 1A, 1B, 1C in college. It really is. It's just you live and die by recruiting. And then it's, hiring good assistants on top of that. I think in the NFL, those guys that jump to it, all of a sudden they just go, oh, okay, free agency is totally different. We joked about with Urban Meyer last night, having no idea how free agency worked, and just how the whole process with, hey, it's highest bidder. That's it. And on top of that, it's also the draft process and just maybe finding what team fits are and understanding what it is. Like being an NFL player, I know we're talking about the coaches, but being an NFL player, it's a grind. It's a different mindset that you have to look for. And maybe some of these college guys go, well, this guy's fast. And it's like, yeah, but the NFL, you gotta find different skill sets that work in the NFL, like translatable skills. I would say the upside for it, being devil's advocate, but the upside is they bring in new ideas to the NFL. Mm-hmm. The NFL can be very stagnant with your ideas.
Chip Kelly is the best example of that, right?
That's exactly it. And I mean, I would say he was ahead of the curve because it was going to go that way anyways, but he kind of forced it. It was maybe 5 years before it was ready to hit the NFL. So maybe it matriculated a little quicker because of him. That's the one really good example. And Chip Kelly did fine in the NFL when he was in the Eagles. That's the thing. It's he was winning a lot of games.
Jim Harbaugh too. And I felt that they brought a lot of interesting schematic quirks. Lot of the run game stuff that they were doing.
Yes.
It seemed like there were a couple of good examples. I mean, those guys had shelf lives. When that approach got a little bit stale, they failed to pivot in any considerable way. And I think that's why their NFL careers pivoted, why they fizzled to a certain extent. Do you feel like there's anything to that organizational leader of men is such bullshit.
I try to avoid that phrase, but I
think just the overall CEO approach, right? When people wanted Matt Campbell, and Matt Campbell being this guy who's done such a good job at Iowa State and him being a hot name in NFL circles, where it's not necessarily this schematic approach or this wizardry on one side of the ball, even though I know Iowa State's defense is doing a lot of interesting mm-hmm. things, but it was this program builder idea. Maybe that's the better term for it. Do you think there's anything to that? Where if you're looking at, all right, this is how you reset what an organization looks like. This is how you build something from the ground up, because that's what Matt Rhule was sold as. Do you think there's anything to that?
Not really, because usually they got to have
running out of reasons to hire these guys. Then
they just got to have a little more substance to them. Campbell might be a decent example, like you said, with the defense, but then you have to decipher, is that because a defense coordinator hired, or is that because of his vision? And also in college, you get these recruiting classes. You get your 3 or 4 years to build these recruiting classes. NFL, it's what we talked about a million times. It's ability to pivot. It's ability to just have different answers for different things, not just in a game plan sense, but as a franchise sense. It's going if we do this, this guy's going to be free. It's just having that kind of midterm plan with short-term and long-term planning. I think NFL, you just have to always be on your game. And also the difference too is in college, you're the dictator. You have to answer to boosters and a little bit the athletic director, but really you get full say and full control. NFL, it's a people's business. It really is. It's a person business, because you have to deal with the GM, execs. Your assistant coaches might not be the guys you wanted, because maybe the GM wants his defensive coordinator. The owner You always got to remember the owner. It all starts at the top too. So it's a different dynamics that exist in the NFL. So it's like, it's just such a different skill set needed for these guys. And it's hard because it is case by case. But I think the one thing is I if I'm going to hire a guy that has college, like from the college ranks, it's like, I want to see maybe 2, 3, 4 years of NFL experience. I know that's hard, like to find that kind of perfect guy, but that's really, it is needed because it's a bucket of cold water on some of these guys once they get to the NFL.
And I do think that there's a consistency aspect to this, right? I mean, Urban Meyer said it. I mean, we heard that early in the season when he told somebody it's like you're playing Alabama every single week. And it is. There are no shortcuts in the NFL. Nope. There's no, I'm going to get the best guys for 2 years early on as a recruiter, and then my team will be good. You have to put it in every day. And I feel like that's kind of what we're seeing with the Panthers, right? Where they want to kind of pivot away from these things and take the short corner to where they want to go. It's like, that's not how this works. If you are disappointed with a guy, there aren't 120 guys standing on the sideline where you have this entire group of pool, you have this entire pool of players that you can pick from. Like, you have to put in the work slowly, methodically. This does not happen overnight. And I think that that's what we've seen a little bit with a couple of these cases.
Well, and I think also it's like, in college, how many blowouts happen early in the year?
Yes.
Just like hanging out. And in NFL, it's like, look at Sunday. I mean, how many times teams just came back? It's such a rubber band effect in this league. It's not just parity. Oh, every team's finishing around 500. It's every week is, like you just said, it's a battle. It's so hard to wake up in December on a Tuesday at 4:30 in the morning and go, okay, I'm putting together third down today. And then, like, you have to do that. Like, in the college, it's just like, hey, we're going to run RPO on third down. Like, we just run our five plays. We're good. All right, what are we doing recruiting? How are we doing there? Like, it's just a different lifestyle that exists with it. And right now, they're in bowl prep. NFL's still going. We still got 4 weeks to go. Like, it's, you know, before we even hit the playoffs, it's a different animal entirely.
It's funny because Cliff Kingsbury has been successful relatively, and he was the worst recruiter. Of all the college coaches that have come to the NFL recently, it feels like he's been the guy with the lowest recruiting pedigree because it was all schematics. And it's almost like he was put in a better position because he went about the college game without the best players all the time.
Yeah, he was just, he was playing on hard mode. Like, just, well, he had Mahomes.
But
there is something to him, like his personality probably vibes with the NFL more. Because college, it's like you have to answer.
I feel like it does. I feel like it absolutely does.
Players probably, there's a reason all the vets went there, like the James Conners and the JJ Watts, because they're like, oh shit, I get to kind of just hang out on a Wednesday and just walk through on a Wednesday and practice in shorts. This guy's not going to grind me to death. Like, that matters too. Like, I love Brett Bielema. We were full pads on Thursdays in the season. Like, you know, it was a totally different way. You can't do that. I mean, Belichick does, but that's his own.
You got to earn world.
You got to earn that. Yeah, you're not going to really tell Belichick to change his ways. And yeah, it works out pretty well.
All right, let's get to our next one here.
Hey, Rob, this is Matt from Raleigh. I just had a question about the Falcons. You know, right now we're kind of in no man's land. You know, I do think Arthur Smith's done a good job of coaching this team up. I think, you know, there's some good things offensively going on. But what do you think Atlanta should do as far as the short-term future? I don't really see a point of keeping Matt Ryan just to keep him. He's an aging quarterback. I don't think we'll be able to re-sign Cordarrelle Patterson. I think he's going to be worth too much money in the offseason. Where do you think the Falcons should go in the offseason as far as free agency in the draft? I'd love to hear what you have to say. Thanks. Bye.
I wanted to answer this question, and I appreciate it, because we haven't really talked about the Falcons very much. They're a team that, if they're winning enough games, and even the show I did with Lindsay last week, where we were talking about which team with four or fewer wins would you rather be, the Falcons weren't in that group, because they have somehow stumbled into enough wins this year. But in all actuality, they're absolutely one of those full-scale rebuilding teams. I mean, they have a few players on really expensive contracts, but other than that, and this roster needs a ton of retooling. So I wanted to ask you, if you're looking at this Falcons team, what do you think their 6-month plan should look like in term as they enter this offseason?
I bet you they wish they could rewind 6 months and maybe take a quarterback in this last draft. But isn't it funny, though, how things shift at that Cordero Patterson is we can't, I don't think we could re-sign Cordero Patterson. Like, that's like,
it's so funny.
He's become like a key cog for like their franchise right now. But that kind of speaks to where they're at, that Cordero Patterson's your guy. I mean, credit to CP, like he's had an awesome year and everything, but they're utilizing him in a great way. I mean, this team is, you know, what I said before then when I bet against them a couple of weeks ago is they're 32nd in DVOA. It was worse than the other teams, Jags, Jets, all Texans. They're put together. The pieces are AJ Terrell, Grady Jarrett, Chris Lindstrom, Kyle Pitts, Jake Matthews, and Calvin Ridley, maybe. Like, you know,
I think that's exactly how to look at this, where it's not what do we need, it's what do we have.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
We need everything else, because I thought that coming into this year, you know, the way that yes. The feeling that I had about their situation coming into the season based on, you know, just the vibe there and just little conversations with people there, it felt like they were really trying to depress expectations. It's like, post Julio trade, it's like, we are not going to be very good. We don't have a lot of talent. We need to understand that. You couldn't name three players on their defense coming into the season. It was Grady Jarrett, AJ Terrell, and Deion Jones. In terms of pieces maybe you could build around. I know Dante Fowler's there, whatever else. That's still how it feels right now, right? Mm-hmm. AJ Terrell looks like a superstar. He looks like one of the best corners in the NFL at this stage. That is a huge win. Kyle Pitts is going to be a really nice piece. We'll see what happens with Calvin Ridley. Obviously, it's such a unique situation. There's really no way to understand it. But when we've seen him play, he's a fantastic player.
Yes.
So if he comes back, and you know, I wish him all the best. If he comes back and he's feeling good next year, and you have a Calvin Ridley and a Kyle Pitts and a couple guys on the offensive line, and then on the defensive side, you have AJ Terrell, you have Grady Jarrett, and think you kind of start over. I mean, it feels like it's going to be a tough situation with the Matt Ryan contract, because even if they trade him, they're still on the hook for $40 million in dead money.
Yeah.
What happened near the end was always going to put them in a really bad spot. They were trying to squeeze every drop they could out of this thing, and eventually the bill comes due, and that's exactly what's going to happen. So this is a multi-year sort of rebuild, and that's why I just think that they should try to get as young as they can, mm-hmm. and who do you retain? I think it's only a few guys that are going to be part of this team moving forward. That was part of the exercise we did with Lindsay the other day. It's like, all right, who are the guys? Like, if you're stacking up the guys that are going to be on this team 3 years from now, who are those guys? And for the Falcons, I think the ones that are guarantees is a very short list. The unfortunate part of this is that when you look at their needs, it's a real tough situation that they invested so much in the offensive line recently, and the offensive line is objectively bad. Like, that's rough. When you spend a first round pick on Caleb McGarry, when you drafted Jalen Mayfield this year and he looks not very good, the issue, right? Is that when you're looking at, we were talking about the Cowboys last night, you know, you're drafting a Tyler Biadasz in the fourth round, Connor Williams, Connor McGovern, functional players. Mm-hmm. And the Falcons, with all of those swings, have not built a functional offensive line. So even the guys that should be building blocks for you don't look like building blocks. And that's put them in a really rough situation.
And they were premium swings, too. Like, it wasn't like you said with those Cowboys guys, those are middle round picks, which is why it's even better that you can get a starter out of it. But it's like, when you miss on a first round lineman, because you have to play them. You're not going to take a lineman in the first round and go, we'll put him on the bench. It's not quarterback. You know, it's not, you know, a corner or, you know, other positions. It's like, no, we have to play this guy. So that's what it kind of, you know, it's a sunk cost, but it's also like, you know, you double down on the negativity there. And that's the thing is, like, Lindstrom is a good player. Like, he's really come along. And so it's like, really, but that's it. It's Terrell, Lindstrom, Pitts, maybe Calvin Ridley, and then whatever you want to do with Grady Jarrett. And that's really it. But that's why that just tells you, it's like, nuke it. I mean, that's it. That should tell you exactly, lead you right to your answer. And that's what, I mean, we talked, it was one of our big conversations in the offseason. We're like, maybe they should kind of lean quarterback and maybe, you know, start building to the future. And they kind of kicked the can down the road. Like you said, the bill became due. And as opposed to what the Saints have done, the Saints nailed a couple drafts in a row, which helped them. But it's like, you know, they're, I don't know, Saints live in La La Land with the salary cap, but it's also, it's like,
even they're in a weird spot now because their quarterback thing is
quarterbacks.
Now, what do you do? And with the Falcons next year, I think it's really easy to look at Matt Ryan at age 37 and with the way his arm looks right now, just be like, well, this is over. I mean, they're going to move on. I mean, what are they going to do? But you look at it, they only save $8 million by trading him. And his base salary is only $16 million. So typically with some of these monster base salaries for quarterbacks, if you can trade them, it's the cash that you're going to save. They don't even save that much cash by trading him next year. And what are you going to do? If you trade him and you still need a veteran quarterback, you're going to have to pay a veteran quarterback. So even if you're getting a $10 million guy, even if you're shopping in the Andy Dalton, Ryan Fitzpatrick aisle from this year, that's still $10 million. Like, starting quarterbacks don't come cheap. So it almost feels like there's a world where Matt Ryan might be the starter here next year, because there's not much that there's not that much relief from moving on from him. Then in 2023, you absolutely can, right? I mean, in 2023, you can just cut him. It's a $15 million dead cap hit. You save $28 million. And in 2023, everyone's hitting free agency. Grady Jarrett's hitting free agency, McGarry, Calvin Ridley. But you got $130 million in cap space, $140 million. You got a blank slate of a team. So I feel like this is a lot more about the next two off seasons than it is about this spring, because the hole that they dug themselves is a deep, deep hole.
2 years in NFL terms is... that's an eternity. Like, that is like, that's usually, it's like, okay, 1 year we grit our teeth and try and, you know, get through it. But it's like, when knowing that and going, oh man, it's just like, but that's the thing. It just, they had an out. They had an out. Like, that's what I thought they did. Like, this spring, they did. And like you said, it's the hole they dug themselves in. That's it's just more frustrating about it. But it's like, I mean, what do you tell the coaches now? It's like, all right, well, this is what we have. Like, you're shopping with discounts. Like, and, also, like, now if, say, they do decide, like, they want to go with a young quarterback to groom behind Matt Ryan, now you have to hit it. You know, this is your swing, and this is not a class you want to do that in. And the guy might be taken that where they're picking at, because now they're at 500 or near 500 right now. So it's like, it's just a lot of speed bumps to get over to put themselves on a path.
Yeah. And that's why I think it's a 2-year process, and there just aren't that many teams we can say that about, but that's the financial reality for where they found themselves.
Looking for an assist with your credit card, but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
You see this? A family watching baseball on DirecTV with no satellite dish in sight.
Let's heckle them.
You call that changing the channel?
Choke up on the remote, buddy.
I hope getting all these games on DirecTV makes up for your mother not pre-chewing your sunflower seeds.
DirecTV has the most MLB games. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Terms and restrictions apply.
All right. Yeah. This is a fun one. I feel like we've talked around this for the entire start of the season. Let's really dig into it here. Alex Porter says, feels like every week Justin Herbert makes an absolutely mind-boggling throw. He sent this last week, by the way, before the throw from yesterday. just for context. But he sent it to you and me, so I wanted to wait until you were on the show.
Perfect.
Said, leading us to talk about how rare that level of arm talent is. But exactly how rare is it? I know you're a big rankings guy, so here's the question. Am I a big rankings guy? I guess I'm a big rankings guy.
Yeah.
Here's the question. Where does Herbert rank among the best arm talents of the last 20 years? I'm specifically going back that far so Nate can include Culpepper if he wants. Off the top of my head, the best arm talents are, in no particular order, Herbert, Josh Allen, Matthew Stafford, Jay Cutler, Brett Favre, Patrick Mahomes, Dante Culpepper, Aaron Rodgers. But feel free to add anyone that I've overlooked. Happy ranking. So I did a story about this on The Athletic last year, and I did of the past 30 years, because that's, one, my lifetime, more or less, since I started watching football, and two, it's hard to find highlights going back further than that. There just isn't a lot of John Elway stuff from early in his career on YouTube. Mm-hmm. It's harder to find. And so that's why I limited it to that stretch. I said Mahomes. I mean, that's where I ended up, and it's because I think arm talent and arm strength are different things. I'm curious, if you were stacking yours up, what would it look like?
Number one of all the guys is Jeff George. And that's it's the tail end of his career in 20 years. I looked it up. He didn't retire until the mid-aughts. So he counts. But Jeff George has the craziest arm talent I've ever seen. And I got to have 1 year with him when I was a kid. But just even rewatching some of the stuff from 1999 when they benched Randall Cunningham, that is the most ridiculous arm ever. And then everyone else is catching up to that. But I would go number two is Mahomes. And then it gets fun. I have Allen in there. I got Josh Allen. I got Favre, Stafford, Rodgers. I would say Rodgers above Stafford and Favre. I think Rodgers is arm talent. Favre had arm strength.
So that is the differentiation to me, right?
That's tough.
So Jeff George had the strongest arm. All right.
But he could do some crazy things.
I think creativity is part of it. I think how you can layer throws is part of it. I think arm angles is part of it. So all of that stuff I take into account. And that's always why Rodgers to me was number one. Favre had a stronger arm than Rodgers. Yes. But some of the things that Rodgers can do slightly on the move, the way that he can layer certain throws to different levels of the field, some of the things that he could get off was just absolutely insane. Aaron Rodgers could do with the football to me was unlike any other passer I had ever seen until Mahomes. And then Mahomes comes along, and just some of the things that Mahomes can do, the whip-like motion that he creates with his arm, and with being able to create that strength and that velocity with his arm alone, Rodgers has, to me, the best torque of any quarterback that I've ever seen. His ability to kind of put his cleats in the ground or have one foot on the ground and use that front foot as like a kickstand to create torque in his upper body, I've never seen anything like that in my entire life.
The crow hop. As soon as you saw Favre give that little crow hop, it was like, oh, here comes a missile.
And all that stuff is amazing. And I think Mahomes, the creativity and the stuff that he can do, in terms of just like that guy is not from this planet arm-wise, Herbert's he's in the conversation. Yeah. I mean, just the pure explosiveness. Like the way the ball jumps out of Herbert's hand to me is right there with any of these guys. I mean, I think that the explosive nature of the way that he throws the ball is probably more impressive than any of these guys.
Because he'll throw 35-yard dig routes, benders and stuff like that, and that thing doesn't move off the screen.
Palmer touchdown yesterday, it looks so casual. And when you see it, it's just like, all right, like that's not that impressive. But then you think about the mechanics of it. That's a 15-yard deep out to the other side of the field where he's throwing it from the hash to the pylon, and it's a laser beam.
The RPO last week against the Bengals.
Yes.
Remember, he's throwing a glance RPO, and actually it was a post RPO. It was fourth outside step by the receiver, and he threw it like a slant. And that is you're exactly right. So I think he's fourth then for me, because I would have Rodgers just a hair above him then, but he's in that category. He's in that tier one category. You know, the other one that I started thinking about more is Vic.
I think, you know what's funny? Vic and Herbert are kind of similar to me because it's the way the ball explodes out of their hand. To me, the giddy up that the ball has coming out of their hands, it looks like, shoots. You know, when you really hit a drive on the screws and it has that like second hop after you hit it. That's what it looks like when Michael Vick and Justin Herbert throw a football, where it looks like it's rising, even though they threw it 60 yards. And to me, the strength that Rodgers has, and you and I have talked about this, Jordy Nelson told me this once, and it makes total sense. I was talking about just the partnership they had, and Jordy was telling me that Rodgers' throws weren't hard to catch because as the ball's coming at you, it doesn't dip. The nose of the ball never changes planes. So you just put your hands straight up, and the trajectory of the ball is coming at you on a straight line. That's arm strength, where you can throw a ball through a wall. And that's what Aaron Rodgers can do. But with Herbert, it's just this kind of spectacular explosion that the ball has. So there are different types of arm strength. But in terms of like just it being a visual spectacle, I think that Herbert is in this conversation with anybody.
I agree. But no, I mean, oh God, it's just so much. I love talking about this stuff because we've talked about them before. Yeah, the exact conversation we've had was, I remember reading a baseball article where they're talking about, do fastballs rise? And they said, yes. No, they don't. They don't, but it's just an optical illusion on your eye that, no, it's actually dipping, but it dips less than your eye thinks that it does.
Yes.
And same thing with these guys. They throw through it. They throw that ball, like you're just saying, it just never dips. So that's why it's so easy to catch. Jimmy Hay, the assistant equipment guy with the Falcons, that's what he said. He said Vic was the easiest guy to catch. He said it was easier than Matt Ryan sometimes, even though he was rocketing it. We've seen, remember the old commercials when guys are getting blown back and the joke commercials with Vic's arm? But it was like, that's what he goes, it was like a pillow when you caught it because it was just, he threw through you. And Herbert has the same thing. When you see him rocket a digger out, rocket a slant in there, and those guys are catching it, it just sticks to those hands. Like Aaron Rodgers, the drops were always low with him, even though he plays in Green Bay in the freezing cold. Like it was like different receivers, didn't matter. It's because, yeah, there's something to that, throwing through a guy. And Favre was the arm strength where it was just like he stuck it on you. You had to catch it. It was like he ingrained you into the pads. This is one of my favorite things. But this is also the thing, too, is I'm glad he brought up Culpepper. That's the difference between arm strength throwing through a wall, because Dante, I would say, was good in that way. But Dante threw the beautiful deep ball. So it's the two different types of arm strengths. And that's what Dante was different with. I wouldn't say he wasn't real creative with the stuff. He could throw on the move really well, but he was just a beautiful, beautiful deep thrower. One of the best ever, really.
I think I tweeted it out. And that's exactly right. His deep ball is absolutely beautiful, but that's a different sort of arm strength.
Correct.
I'm gonna try to find it. I think it's on my Twitter. I asked Rodgers once what he thought was the hardest he ever threw a football. And it was against the Falcons in the playoffs in 2000. Or, maybe not the playoffs. It was against the Falcons in 2010. And he told me about it. And Jordy L. Nelson always mentioned it. It was in the back of the end zone. And it's that thing where he gets like a running start. And then he uses one foot as a kickstand. And so he does this incredible thing where he stops all of his momentum and is able to kind of create torque in his upper body. So the mechanics look right. But it's just, think about it. Think about when you're in a car crash, right?
Yeah.
And when things stop, you create this forward momentum with yourself. And that's exactly what it was, this inertia that he had. And it was incredible to watch. I mean, the ball is traveling like 80 miles an hour. It's absolutely insane. So there are just throws like that where it's like, God, these guys are just doing a different thing than everybody else is.
Exactly.
All right. Let's get to our next voicemail.
Yes, my name is Derek. I'm from Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada. Big fan of the show. Big fan of yours, Robert. I wanted to call this question. I was waiting for Nate to come in because, like Nate, I'm a huge old school wrestling fan, and I know Nate's a big fan of OSW Review. So Nate will get this question. So who would be, if you could pick players, who would be in your boys stable for NFL players if you pick four or five? Now, basically, a guy that you like that necessarily wasn't the best. Nate could probably explain it better, but maybe Robert, someone like Charlie Whitehurst, when you and Barnwell pretty much kind of had like a love affair with him back in the Grantland days. Hopefully the question gets on, and keep up the great work, guys.
All right, you're going to have to explain this to me.
Okay, so yeah, OSW Review is an awesome YouTube like podcast, and they just review old wrestling pay-per-views, and it's amazing because it's actually one of the reasons I got back into wrestling is I started watching those videos. But they have a boys table where it's basically your favorite wrestler that wasn't like a world champ. Like, who's your boy? Kind of like a schlocky pick, you know, like, so like for me in wrestling, it would be like Goldust, like Billy Kidman.
Oh, Goldust. Yeah.
Saturn, you know, guys that weren't, it's not the, you know, the Rocks or Stone Cold Steve Austin's. It's the middle, Scott Hall, like those guys, like that, those kind of upper mid-tier guys. And it's always and so OSW Review, this is how popular it is that some of their fans have gotten tattoos with the show, and I'm not asking anyone to get that with our show, but and then they get to pick their boys table and they do it on one of the shows. So for football wise, it'd be like your favorite non-Pro Bowl players. I think that'd be a good way to
non-Pro Bowl players is tough.
I know. That's why the boys table's fun. Like, so for like currently Nyheim Hines, like that.
Oh yeah. That's a really good one. That's a really good one.
Kendrick Bourne. Like for all time, I have a whole bunch of Vikings. Like I have Nate Burleson, Mwelde Moore, Jermaine Wiggins. Like those are boys, you know, it's like only like a specific fan base, like remembers those guys. So you probably have some Bears up there. Maybe some.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah. I definitely do. I mean, I'm trying to think of like the guys that since I started watching football that are like some of my favorites. Like Michael Bennett is probably too good, but like I loved Michael Bennett. Like when he was on the Bucks, I love Michael Bennett. Like before he even signed with the Seahawks, he was one of my guys. Remember Chris Myers, the center for the Texans? I always loved Chris Myers. Like I just thought that, and when you saw Chris Myers, he was like a 280-pound dude who played center in the NFL in this hyper-specific way. And I always really liked him for that exact reason. It's just like, man, what a strange guy.
It's kind of like the guys you like that aren't like the prototypical guys. It's like, no, that's my guy. Like Zach Pascal. Like that's another one. Like, you know, like just the Colts have a lot of them, but
do have a lot of them.
Yeah. But it's Alec Ingold, you know, like, you know,
I was going to say CJ Ham. Like CJ Ham is one of those guys for me.
Yes. Great example. CJ Ham's another one. Yeah. But like those types and, but that's when I saw that this question was going to be on there, I lost my mind. I like even told my wife, I was like, my worlds are colliding right now. Like that someone's referring to that three Irish guys that review old wrestling pay-per-views on my, the podcast I'm on every week.
I feel like mine are going to be too good. Like Kenny Moore would be one of mine. Like he might be too good though. Like that's the problem. That's a really tough needle to thread. Like I just feel like I'd have to really, really think about it for guys that are like one step down from that range.
It's hilarious too on the show because they always argue whether that guy's too good. Like one of them was like Christian, you know, like Christian and Edge.
Yeah.
And then they're like, no, he's too good to be in your. And he's like, no, I made up the rules for it. And so that's always like the discussion, like a guy that's too good to be on there. But
one of my guys this year is definitely Jalen Thompson. Jalen Thompson is definitely on my list this year. Like, I feel like he is kind of the epitome of that for this particular season. But I'd have to really go back and think about it overall.
I know, but it's great to think about. And I think that's the football equivalent as non-Pro Bowl player. So you're all the super role players that we all love to give shouts. I was trying to think of some linemen, and I was kind of disappointed in myself. I didn't come up with any linemen because maybe I focus too much on the bad ones now.
All right, I'll do some more thinking about it. I'll do some more thinking about it, and we'll see what we get. All right, I really like this one. Daniel Frazier asks, how differently would you feel about the Bucks and Pats if we swapped Mac Jones and Tom Brady on either team? Would this be the best Pats team besides the 07 team? Would the Bucks make the playoffs? I love this. I thought this was a fascinating exercise. It's a very different offense in Tampa. Because Mac Jones and Tom Brady, even 44-year-old Tom Brady, have very different physical abilities.
Yes.
Right? So the vertical aspect of what the Bucs are on offense, I think, would be harder to pull off with Mac Jones. I
agree.
It definitely would not be the best Pats offense since 07. The 2011 Patriots offense is one of the best offenses of all time. I mean, that 2011 team gets lost because it didn't win the Super Bowl. And two, because the 2011 season is one of the most statistically productive seasons we've ever seen in NFL history. I mean, Drew Brees threw for 5,000 yards and didn't win the MVP that year for a playoff team because of how good Aaron Rodgers was. Like that season is absolutely insane. But if you look at the stats offensively for that 2011 Patriots team, it's wild. So, I mean, this Pats team, I think, would still be very, very good on offense, but I still think that their overall ceiling is limited just because of the explosiveness that they lack, right?
Yes.
So they'd be efficient. They'd be better with Tom Brady, but I don't know how much better they would be in terms of their overall ceiling because, again, I just think you lack that vertical aspect of the offense. And the Bucs would just look so much different. They would look so much different with Mac Jones because the offense just has to change.
Yeah. I mean, and Arians wouldn't play a rookie. But this is a great question. It was. I had to think about it for a little bit. But I hate to sound like a broken record. Yeah, I completely agree with you because that's the same points that I put up there. I said the 2011 Patriots team was sick. Gronk, Wes Welker. I mean, God, it was such a cool team. Danny Woodhead was on there like when he was still like, you know, he was kicking around then. But it was. I think this Patriots team it'd be more like with Brady would be like more of those mid 2010 Patriots teams with, you know, like a good defense and an offense. Like you said, it's efficient more than explosive. You know, having Gronk also helps too in those mid 2010 teams. But yeah, I really have nothing more to add on. I think that's exactly how I look at it as too. It's just Brady's arm strength is what makes the whole Bucs thing work. You need to push the ball on that because they ask you out of it. You only can, you know, throw it underneath. Mac Jones is super accurate and would know where to go with the ball, but he would have some limitations on what is asked in Arians' offense.
Yeah, I think that's it. I mean, I feel like they would all they'd both be still be really good. I think that obviously the Patriots offense would be a little bit better. I still think the Bucs offense would be above average, like significantly above average with Mac Jones, but they would just have to do different things.
Hey, Fidelity, how can I remember to invest every month?
With the Fidelity app, you can choose a schedule and set up recurring investments in stocks and ETFs.
Oh, that sounds easier than I thought.
You got this.
Yeah, I do. Now, where did I put my keys?
You will find them where you left them.
Investing involves risk, including risk of loss. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC, member NYSE, SIPC.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart, the seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
All right, let's get to our last voicemail here.
Hey, Robert. Hey, Nate. Love the show. One of my favorite things that you guys do is talk about Hall of Very Good, Hall of Fame. Last mailbag with Mitch, you guys talked about Whitworth and Peters and touched on a little bit on Cam Hayward as far as, like, is he a Hall of Fame player or the Hall of Very Good? And this last week, Whitworth started left tackle at 40 years old. But another major player that was in the news was Cam Jordan and missing his first game in his entire career. And it made me think, you know, is Cam Jordan a Hall of Famer? And I'd really be interested to hear your guys' thoughts on, like, is Cam Jordan a Hall of Famer? Another couple ones that came to mind if you want to hit on is A.J. Green a Hall of Famer? And then one I constantly ask people all the time because I'm not sure is the Legion of Boom. Everyone says Richard Sherman Hall of Famer, Bobby Wagner Hall of Famer, Earl Thomas Hall of Famer. But then I think about, is Cam Chancellor a Hall of Famer? Anyways, love the show, guys. Hope to hear from you. Bye.
All right. Let's start with Cam Jordan. Where are you at with Cam Jordan?
A lock.
You think he's a lock for the Hall of Fame?
He's on the All-Decade team. We're good. He's a lock. Lock. He's going to have 100 sacks. He missed the first game of his entire career. I think he's a lock. It might take a couple years, but he's a lock. He's on the All-Decade team. That's easy for me. Maybe I'm just a biased Cam Jordan fan, apparently.
All right. So here's my stance about the All-Decade team, okay? The way the All-Decade team is comprised, I think that Cam Jordan deserves to be on it, okay? Because the way they do this is nonsense. There are six linebackers on the All-Decade team, and half of them are edge rushers. So the defensive ends on the All-Decade team are Calais Campbell, Cam Jordan, Julius Peppers, and J.J. Watt. The fact that Julius Peppers is on it for the 2010s is insane, by the way. And Julius Peppers is ridiculous. So that means that Cam Jordan is on there, but all of the edge rushers that would be ahead of him in the edge rushing conversation are listed at linebackers. Is Cam Jordan one of the five best edge rushers of the last decade since he entered the NFL?
No, but that's the thing. He's going to end up with 100 sacks and he has the accolades and he's been on.
He's only been all pro one time.
I know. How many Pro Bowls did he have?
Six,
right? Okay.
I think Cam Jordan is an awesome player. I think just penciling him in may be a little bit fast.
I think he ends up getting in. I really do. It's not going to be first ballot, no brainer, you know, like JJ will end up or something like that. But it's just going to be, I just think it's just that it's going to be one of those great consistent careers that gets rewarded, and he just has enough accolades where it's like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But it might be like year five that he finally gets, you know, gets enough votes. But I think he gets in. I think maybe I'm just biased to Cam Jordan because I just love him as a dude too. Like just like
he's awesome. Love if Cam Jordan got into the Hall of Fame. But if you look at it from 2011 when he got drafted to 2021, okay. I think that you could make an argument. Von Miller is definitely better at that position, right?
Yes.
Has Chandler Jones had a better career than Cam Jordan?
Chandler Jones had a better peak or has had better seasons, but not a better career, if that makes sense.
I think that's a conversation. Chandler Jones has 105 sacks. He came into the league 1 year after Cam Jordan did. It is so hard. In the year of our Lord 2021 to be underrated, Chandler Jones has managed it. He has somehow managed sacks. In the internet era to be underrated, which is almost impossible to do, but he still manages to do it. J.J. Watt, absolutely. Right. Like, yeah. I mean, it's J.J. Watt is an all-timer. Justin Houston?
So that's where we get – that's the realm that we're getting in. Oh, man.
That to me is the cut. And then I think Khalil Mack, since he came into the league, has been a more dominant player than Cam Jordan.
And Khalil Mack's got two defensive player of the years. Maybe three now?
Khalil Mack has 76.5 sacks, but he came into the league 3 years after Cam Jordan came into the league.
Yeah. And right. Khalil, but Khalil got the accolades, and yeah, and he's Khalil Mack. You know, he's on that name basis. But I think it's just one of those where Cam gets in just because of like the longevity kind of thing. I mean, and also just like he's been very good for very long. And I think that does end up being rewarded. But like the Justin Houstons of the world, that's a fun one too. Man, I'm thinking
if you could have 9 years or 8 years, they're 8 year peaks. Of Cam Jordan or Cam Wake, who would you pick?
Cam Jordan.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. He's a badass, man.
I pick Cam Wake just because I loved Cam Wake. Cam Wake came into the league at 27. Like that's also just such a weird part of it.
The weirdest career ever.
I guess 8 years. Well, I'd say 8 years maybe too much. Cam Wake had 10.5 sacks at 35 years old.
Yeah. So Cam Wake's like the Edgar Martinez of football. Like just didn't have his breakout year enter the league until 27 and just was like playing up until like he was late 30s and producing.
Cam Jordan is a fantastic player. I think he probably will end up getting in because he'll get 100 sacks and the all-decade team thing does help. But I'm not as quick to say it's a lock as you are. Let's get to a couple of the other guys on here. Like Do you think AJ Green is a Hall of Famer?
This one was tough. I think he's the same category as Cam Jordan, where it's like he ends up a Hall of Famer, but it's going to take forever to happen. I mean, he has 7 Pro Bowls. He has a couple of second team All Pros. He has a great peak. You know, he had a 3-4-ish year period where he's, you know, top 3 receiver in the league. And then he's going to probably end up with 10,000 yards, which also is just, you know, voters love those little parameters that they hit. So I think he ends up, but man, that one's tough. AJ Green was really tough for me to decide on. I say he ends up that, but there's going to be a lot of receivers soon.
I think that's part of the problem is that the glut of receivers may hurt AJ Green.
Yeah.
Also, he's overshadowed in his own draft class. Like the fact that, and obviously, honestly, Cam Jordan has the same issue, right? I mean, Von Miller, J.J. Watt all came into the same year, came into the league the same year that Cam Jordan did. Julio Jones walks into the Hall of Fame, and AJ Green's in the same class as Julio Jones. So I think that's a little bit of a complicating factor there. And then we're in an era where so many guys are going to have 10,000 yards, right?
Yeah.
I mean, Larry Fitzgerald had 9,200 yards in the 10 years since AJ Green came into the league. So, I mean, Larry Fitzgerald is going to be in that conversation. I mean, there's a really good chance that Devontae Adams gets there by the time that AJ Green would be eligible for the Hall of Fame. Devontae's at 7,700 yards, 7,800 yards right now. I mean, there are a lot of guys I think they're going to be right there that are going to kind of muddy that picture for AJ Green.
Green needs more, like 3 more years, and that's hard, of like the year he's having right now, where he's just like a nice, tangible player for somebody, like a winning team, like because he just needs his second act of his career. Like it was like he had a great first act, and then it was just like, okay, he got banged up, and then you kind of, you know, the Bengals kind of were the Bengals for a few years. So it's like he needs his second act, but that's, he's going to be the cutoff, man. Like, that's like, he's going to be the barometer for like, is he better than AJ Green or is he worse than AJ Green for everybody that comes after, I think.
Feels like DeAndre Hopkins is going to get in when it's all said and done. Yeah. He's got 10,000 yards already. He came into the league 2 years after these guys did. Mike Evans is going to walk into the Hall of Fame. Mike Evans has, in only 8 years, Mike Evans has 9,151 yards and 72 touchdowns. Since 2011, Mike Evans is third among all players in touchdown catches behind Antonio Brown and Rob Gronkowski, even though he came into the league 3 years after some of these guys did.
Wow.
That's going to be a lot easier than it might even seem on the surface for Mike Evans to get in. He's going to be like a no doubt about it Hall of Famer.
Oh, yeah. And how old is he right now? Is he 30? Mike Evans isn't that old either. Like 29?
He's
like,
28. He's 28? He's 28.
Oh, my God. He's going to like, oh, my God. Jesus. He's going to be up there. Like, and that's we talk about underrated in a way. It's not that we underrate Mike Evans. We know he's a star, but it's like, man, that's a hell of a career on teams that weren't really doing much else for a few years.
Mike Evans's least productive season in the NFL was in 2017. Okay. When he played 15 games, he had 1,000 yards and 5 touchdowns. That's his least productive NFL season.
Pretty good.
He had 1,000 yards last year. That's a target number situation, right? And mm-hmm. the Bucs team, he averaged 9.2 yards per target last season with the Bucs, even though he only had 1,000 yards. If you look at it, this is the number of guys who averaged more than 9.2 yards per target since 2011. Tyreek Hill, Jordy Nelson, Kenny Galladay, Chris Godwin, Tyler Lockett, Gronk, George Kittle, Julio Jones, Malcolm Floyd, which is amazing, DeSean Jackson, Debo, AJ Brown, Johnny Knox, Jamar Chase, and Justin Jefferson. Those guys are kind of fake because they don't have that many targets, yeah. And neither does Johnny Knox. But that's how productive Mike Evans was last year, and it was one of the least voluminous years of his entire career. Mike Evans is having like a quietly insane football career.
God,
even when you account for era, what Mike Evans is doing is absolutely wild.
And some of the teams he's had to play on, and like it's just like he is scheme proof as they get. Like, it's just like everybody loves that big ass X receiver. They can just toss the ball up at any time. That I love the chemistry he has with Brady. It's just
it's
one awesome. Of the most fun
things. So it's cool to watch. Also, speaking of good dudes, I have heard very few people talk about an NFL player the way that other people talk about Mike Evans. Like, it is, people revere Mike Evans.
My only interaction with him was at the combine in the train station where they're doing interviews with the assistant coaches. And this one assistant coach, like took Mike Evans and went to like the little stairwell thing. Like, that sounds really weird, but he was just taking him to like private, after, like, his interview with him. And it's supposed to be on a horn that no one else listens to. Scouts and coaches are going to know anyone that listens to this. It's just hilarious. But it's supposed to be 15 minutes. And this coach had him for like an hour. And he looked at me, and this is when he still had braces. And I remember he looked at me because I'm sitting there waiting to grab him. And he just goes, "Save me." And he's just like, that's all he said. Like, you know, I was just like, "Hey, okay, time up." And I came in. He's like, "Thank you so much." Like, because the coach was just talking his ear off, like just talking and talking and talking. I could tell him, he's like, "Are you going to ask me a question? Or are you going to talk about like your life?" Like, but he was just like so funny, like so just like normal. Like, you know, and some of these players aren't like that. So it's, yeah, I'm a fan. I'm a fan of Mike Evans.
All right, very quickly, the Legion of Boom guys. Bobby Wagner, zero doubt.
Yeah,
like, zero doubt.
Yeah.
Richard Sherman, to me, is a Hall of Famer. I think that Richard Sherman is definitely going to get in. The Earl Thomas thing, that's going to be a complicated conversation, I feel like.
Yeah, that's something else.
Yes, so we don't have to talk about that. I think Cam Chancellor is firmly a Hall of Very Good player.
Yes. And he's going to have against him kind of like those early 2000 Bucks players kind of had, where it's like, well, how many of these guys can we vote in? Yep. Like, you know, so that's what I completely agree. That's exactly how I have it written, is that he's a Hall of Very Good and a damn good one at that.
Oh, he's one of my favorite Hall of Very Good players. He is one of the reasons the Hall of Very Good exists, is because of guys like Cam Chancellor.
The Cam Chancellor wing.
All right, last one here from Devin Harvey. He said, "I remember Nate comparing playing quarterback as a rookie in the NBA, where being even a somewhat positive contributor is impressive. I've also heard that cornerback is a very hard position for rookies to be positive contributors. What would you both say are the hardest positions for rookies to be positive impact players, and which positions are the easiest?" He maintains that no position is easy. He understands that, but I think it's a good way to frame the question.
Yep.
What do you think about this?
Hardest, yeah, quarterback, obviously. But then off that, corner, yes, I would say is number two. And then tackle, offensive. Really, it's what it is. Is close your eyes and think of what the premium positions are. Is that's kind of what it's going to get into, what the hardest is. I actually think tight end is, it's so hard to be a tangible tight end as a rookie. It really is. Like, to be like a starter and playing like every snap or a lot of snaps, that's really hard. Center, I think, it's really hard. Like, if you're going to be a starting center day one, that's usually a huge transition. And maybe that's just my, you know, just being around it. But that's what I have. You don't think tackle?
I think a lot of guys have succeeded at tackle pretty early. A lot of guys have come in and played the position well. And I think that mm-hmm. there are some cases where we've seen guys take jumps. But, you know, like Tristan Wirfs came in last year and was an all-pro player right away. And yeah. I think there are some positions where that's really hard to do. Quarterback, obviously, being number one. The one that, to me, running back is the easiest.
Easiest.
Right? Yeah. I mean, running back, we see rookies all the time, can just explode onto the scene. I think that's the easiest. I think guard is also one where if you have the goods, you can be an all-pro player right away. Think about what Zach Martin was. Think about what Quentin Nelson was. That's one where, and I think that's why guard and tackle, to me, tackle is obviously harder. But I feel like what it takes to be a good offensive lineman, it's such a learned position. And if you know how to play it and you understand, like, I understand body control and I understand angles and I understand how to take this stuff away. If that's stuff that you just innately understand when you're a prospect, I think you can succeed right away in the NFL. If you're a toolsy prospect who needs to learn, I think it's different. To me, it depends on what type of player you were coming out, I guess, is how I would frame it. But I think at some positions, it doesn't matter how well you know it. To me, the most underrated one that is kind of counterintuitive, you wouldn't think that it's hard to play right away, off-ball linebacker. You very rarely see off-ball linebackers come into the NFL and play well right away because it's just too many moving parts. Yes. The eye discipline that you need and the way the game moves, especially now, if you look at the way the college game is, like over the last 5 years or so, I guess it's kind of shifting now, but let's say the college game 5-10 years ago, where it's so spread out and you're playing off the ball and there isn't a lot of traffic. And now you're coming into this NFL game, even in an 11 personnel world where you have all of these shifts, all of these motions, all of these pulling guards, the things that you have to pay attention to, guys swim. Even players drafted really high. Devin White, Devin Bush, guys that we've seen drafted in the top 10, Roquan Smith early in his career, guys that we've seen turn into stars, it takes time for them to get there. Isaiah Simmons is another really good example. Yes. Zaven Collins can't even get on the field right now for the Cardinals because of all of these considerations. So I think that one is one that people just don't think enough about when you feel like the learning curve is steep.
It's hilarious you said that, because at first I like put that as my last easiest and I changed it to one of the last ones. I go, it's hilarious you said this, because I go, I want to talk about this. I have a dash talk about this, because we for late, I would say, 07 to 2012 ish, a whole bunch of linebackers running rookie of the year, because back then you could just plug. You could just go, all right, I'm gonna be a rundown linebacker, and just, you didn't have to worry about, like you just say, all the coverage stuff. Now, you enter the NFL, they have to worry about personnel. They have to worry about down and distance, communicating that stuff, blitz looks. Hey, who's three, who's two, who's one, who's this, whatever, communicating with this. Starting up, mugged up on the ball, and then having to work backwards. I mean, look, as great as like Micah Parsons is playing, as that, look at him the first couple of weeks in coverage when he's just like, he's a great athlete, so he can recover. But I mean, his head's spinning on stuff. I mean, people were trying to make fun of it early in the year, but it's like that. It's hard. It really is hard. More is being asked of every position now. It is so mentally taxing on every single position that, yes, you want to have the athleticism to overcome that. But yeah, that's obviously, running back is the easiest one, and guard, yep, I had that. And I said maybe D tackle, like maybe a nose tackle. Like that would be another one where it's just
nose
like,
tackle is one where you can get plugged right away.
Because you don't have to worry about anything.
I think this is interesting. If you look at the list of Defensive Rookie of the Year winners, okay?
Yeah.
From 2006 through 2009, it was all linebackers. And then even before that, Jonathan. So from 2004 to 2009, it was every year but one was an off-ball linebacker. Jonathan Vilma, D'Amico Ryans, Patrick Willis, Gerard Mayo, Brian Cushing. What did we just say about 2011? That's when the passing boom happens.
Yep.
So as the game spreads out to a shotgun 11 personnel world, you saw fewer linebackers having that sort of impact immediately. The only one was Kuechly, and Kuechly was just a savant. I mean, he was just
it's Kuechly.
He was a virtuoso. I mean, he was just a phenom. So, and even he'll tell you, I think, that what he understood about the game as a rookie compared to year two was completely different. The only other linebacker since Luke Kuechly, off-ball linebacker, to win Defensive Rookie of the Year was Darius Leonard. I mean, for the most part, that's not happening. And you look at edge guys like Nick Bosa, it's hard to have the impact that a Nick Bosa had as a rookie, or even his brother as an off-ball linebacker in today's NFL. I think it's just more difficult. That's why when you see Micah Parsons and why he's going to win it, it's not because of what he does as an off-ball linebacker. It's because of what he does as a pass rusher.
Exactly. And it's just, that's a way tangible because he's going forward. Now you have to go backwards a whole lot of times. And as we know in pass protection, it's very hard to go backwards. And so now defenders are worrying more and more about that. That's why corner is hard. That's why coverage for linebackers is hard. It's just where the game is right now. And it's like, that is a great way to actually see the transition of the game. Just looking at defensive rookies of the year, it's just like, oh, there's the change in the NFL was right then and there.
I very rarely do this. Someone should go back and listen to our draft podcast when we were talking about Micah Parsons. I can't remember what show it was on. It might have even been with you. We were talking about Micah Parsons, and I think I uttered the words, I would never have him moving backwards on passing downs. Yep. I just watched him play in college. I was like, ah, that guy's just moving forward on every single passing down, and he's done pretty good at it.
Yep.
it's been a smart way to deploy him in the NFL as a rookie.
We were talking about, I don't know what the discussion was, because I brought him up, and we were like, oh, yeah. I was like, oh, man, you know, he's a freaky dude, and you're like, yeah. As long as he's going forward, it's just like, I think that's, I swear. So it must've been in June. So I wonder what the show was. I don't know. They all blend together now.
I remember saying that explicitly and then seeing what he's doing right now. I was like, oh man, even a blind squirrel every once in a while gets one of these right.
I always say my house sigil is a broken clock. That's what it is.
All right. That was very fun. Appreciate you doing that, buddy. I always love when you jump on here and do this. We will be back with Mitch later in the year. As always, guys, thank you very, very much for sending these in. We have a fun time doing this. I hope that comes across. We really enjoy it. We really enjoy it because of how thoughtful, how interesting, how just joyful some of these questions are. So thank you very much for sending them in. We will be back tomorrow with Kurt Warner. Kurt Warner is going to come on. We're going to talk about some quarterback play in the NFL this year. I had some guys that I really wanted to ask him about because I think it's been kind of a different year for the types of quarterbacks we've seen succeed. And I think a lot of them have been in the same mold as Kurt Warner was. So I wanted to get his input on some of those guys and some of the younger quarterbacks, and the style of quarterback that we've seen be successful so far in the NFL. So please come back and check out that on Wednesday. We'll be back with our regularly scheduled programming after that, with Lindsay on Thursday, with Nate and Sheil on Friday. In the meantime, please rate and review the podcast on your podcast platform of choice. I would sincerely appreciate that. Please subscribe to The Athletic, theathletic.com/football show. We'll be back tomorrow. Appreciate you guys listening. We'll talk to you soon.
This was The Athletic Football Show.